we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
The battle over the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy on immigration is intensifying, with lawmakers in both parties condemning it as cruel and inhumane. The administration still defends the strategy.
Thousands of people protested across Texas yesterday. They accused the administration of punishing undocumented children by removing them from their parents. The Department of Homeland Security confirms 1,995 children were separated from their parents between April 19th and May 31st.
Because we sent a message, a bad message, to those crossing illegally to, if you bring children, you can avoid prosecution and deportation.
This is incredible. Trump administration officials have been sending babies and other young children to at least three tender age shelters in South Texas. Lawyers and medical providers just... I think I'm going to have to hand this off.
This morning, the Trump administration says it will eventually reunite the roughly 2,000 migrant children who remain separated from their families, stressing all the kids have been accounted for. It comes as President Trump is ramping up his anti-immigration rhetoric, calling America's system a mockery and describing undocumented immigrants as invaders.
The U.S. does not have a problem with mass migration. The U.S. has a problem with white supremacy, constituting the other side of a colonial and imperialist coin, which far more than democracy informs the reality of its existence. The outcry unleashed by liberal America in response to the Trump administration's monstrous policy of family separation at the border with Mexico, since rolled back courtesy of an executive order, has been revelatory. You would think that before Trump arrived on the scene, all was rosy in the garden of US democracy, where the myth of the American dream and a post-racial society was in fact reality. The country, indeed, a torchbearer for liberty, freedom, tolerance, and human rights. The enduring power of these national myths, their success in maintaining the lie that has concealed the brutal truth of the United States from its inception in 1776 up to the present day, is reflected in the state of denial in which liberal America continues to cocoon itself. White supremacy, for the purposes of clarification, is not only a racial construct, it is also an ideological construct. Thus, America's first black president, Barack Obama, he served the cause of white supremacy during his tenure in the White House. Thus, every black and brown police officer serves the cause of white supremacy. Likewise, black and brown prison guards, judges, court officials, soldiers, military officers, and so on. That they do so unconsciously and unthinkingly is a measure of the power of said national myths that are the bedrock upon which the nation's sense of self rests. Ideology, Louis Althusser reminds us, after all, has very little to do with consciousness. It is profoundly unconscious. The point is that in the US experience, freedom and democracy are inextricably linked to white supremacy, i.e., the more white, or the more that you act white, the more worthy you are of freedom and democracy. And it is this dynamic that enables border guards to wrench screaming and pleading children from their parents' grasp and place them in holding pens with pristine indifference to their pain. White supremacy informs every aspect of officialdom in the US, but especially the implementation of an immigration policy predicated on the othering of poor black and brown people. Obama, during his time in office, deported over 2 million so-called illegal migrants, in process of which families were separated. Yet today, he is held up around the world as some kind of moral giant, an icon of liberal America. The abiding misfortune of Central and Latin America is to be located adjacent to the United States. The fundamental cause of the grinding poverty, instability, corruption, crime, and dysfunction that is a feature of countries such as Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and El Salvador today is the United States, victims as they have been and are of US domination and exploitation. Mass migration is a symptom of the catastrophic consequences of global capitalism in crisis, with Washington, in this context, the equivalent of the Death Star. Depending on your point of view, history provides a warning or a reason to hope. For just as the Western Roman Empire fell due to mass migration, we are invited to ponder if its US counterpart today is headed for the same fate for the same reason. Ultimately, Donald Trump is America, and America is Donald Trump. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, I'm delighted to be joined on this episode by US historian and writer, Professor Gerald Horn. Gerald, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, you heard my introduction. I locate this issue in white supremacy. Its roots are white supremacist. Your views on this, please.
Well, I have to say, I'm a little taken aback that someone speaks the truth about the United States of America. Living here, one becomes accustomed to hearing mythology and fables, and it becomes almost startling and shocking when one hears truth. So thank you for that, even though I'm still a bit shaken by it all. First of all, to your point, it's quite remarkable that despite the fact that in places like Boston and Chicago, there are thousands upon thousands of undocumented migrants of Polish and Irish descent who are hardly molested or annoyed in their day-to-day activities. On the southern border of the United States, as you suggested, you have infants being torn from the arms of their weeping mothers. This is certainly an expression of white supremacy. It's a reflection of the fact that the Trump majority, the Trump base in this country, feels that those from Latin America are less likely to vote in favor of the party of white supremacy, which is the Republican Party, whereas they feel that those of Polish and Irish descent in Chicago and Boston, if they become naturalized as U.S. citizens, will faithfully join the so-called white majority in voting for the Republican Party. Now, those of us who have a familiarity with the United States as opposed to the myths of the United States are not surprised by this turn of events. We know that on July 4th, 1776, when the United States was formed in its rebellion against London, it was driven to this fateful decision, not least because in the Royal Proclamation of 1763, London had expressed reluctance to keep waging war against the Native Americans in order to seize their land for European settlers, then defined as white. And secondly, in June 1772, London had abolished slavery in England. There was a fear on the part of slave owners, including George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and the other founders of this slaveholders' republic, that that decision would leapfrog the Atlantic, thereby jeopardizing their fortunes. And so they rebelled and formed the United States of America. In that sense, this country is not unlike Rhodesia, which, as you know, seceded from London in 1965 because they felt London was moving towards African majority rule. Or it's not unlike the settlers' revolt in Algeria in the late 1950s, early 1960s, when there was a fear that France was going to be turning over Algeria to the majority, thereby jeopardizing the fortunes of those residing in North Africa of French descent. Sadly and unfortunately, once again, it's very difficult to get the truth to the people of the United States, which is one of the reasons why the whole world right now is careening towards disaster with Mr. Trump at the wheel. And I have to say, I'm a little taken aback by events in Berlin in particular. As you know, in recent days, Mr. Trump, in everything but deed, certainly in words, has sought to undermine the government of Chancellor Merkel and has sought to empower, to use the words of his ambassador, Richard Grenell in Berlin, a right-wing populist who you might call neo-fascist, not only in Germany, but throughout Central Europe, including Austria, and dipping southward into Italy. It seems to me that the Europeans bear some culpability because they swallowed the mythology of the United States of America. They remind me of the British Army in Singapore in February 1942, which had their guns pointed in the wrong direction and therefore fell victim to Japanese invaders and then, of course, wound up being interned. Germany and a good deal of Western Europe have had their anger and venom directed eastward towards Moscow, when obviously it should have been directed westward towards Washington. And now they will have to pay a very heavy price.
Absolutely. I've maintained, Gerald, that the problem within the European Union or Western Europe has never been Russia. It is and has always been the US. Charles de Gaulle, I think, had it right when he said that Europe, the whole of Europe, from the Atlantic to the Urals, will decide the fate of the world. While I may not agree with him when he makes that such a pompous boast about deciding the fate of the world, I do agree with him when he identifies the problem for Europe as the United States. Western Europe, essentially a satellite of US foreign policy, and indeed it's their economic model that's been embraced by the EU, which has given us this unremitting crisis economically, which is feeding this migrant crisis. And it's interesting that you mentioned Algeria in your very eloquent statement there, Gerald, because I have a story here in front of me which is unremittingly shocking. And this is happening as we speak. And this is from the World Socialist website, which I've always found to be a very credible source of news. And it reads, and I quote, "More than 13,000 refugees and migrants, including pregnant women and children, have been forced marched into the Sahara Desert by Algerian security forces over the past 14 months, where many of them have died from hunger and exposure. The refugees are being forced by Algerian security forces into the Sahara without food or water, and in many cases, after being robbed of their money and cell phones, they are pointed in the direction of the nearest settlement in Niger, over 9 miles away, across empty sands, where the temperatures rise as high as 120 degrees Fahrenheit. The murderous policy of the Algerian government is being carried out at the behest of the countries of the European Union, which have increasingly sought to induce North African regimes to act as their border guards, impeding the flow of migrants by means of intimidation, violence, and death." This seems to me, Gerald, to be a full-blown biblical crisis, or indeed a crisis of biblical scale, involving the underdeveloped world moving towards the developed world upon the crises that have been inflicted upon them by the developed world, economically, militarily, and culturally.
Well, certainly, I would only add the friendly amendment that it's also a crisis of world imperialism. That is to say that imperialism, in terms of its machinations, has foisted underdevelopment upon what is called the global south, preventing what is called the global south from redistributing the wealth or perhaps moving towards a socialist model of sustainability, and instead has foisted upon what is called the global south a model which basically presupposes complete hegemony and domination by Paris, Washington, London, Brussels, etc. That model has become increasingly unsustainable. And so not only do you have, as a direct result, the factor of people moving from Central America northward to Texas and the United States, but moving from Africa northward to Europe. But you also have the other wrinkle, which is relatively new, of U.S. imperialism deciding that it cannot really confront China, which is now the monster of choice in Washington, in the way it would like to, unless it turns the European Union into vassal states, puppet states. And therein, you have the attempt to destabilize the government in Berlin. Therein, you have the attempt to slap sanctions and tariffs on governments like Canada and Japan and the European Union. That is to say, the United States is going to try to extract wealth from its erstwhile allies in some ways to make up for the shortfall as a result of the December 2017 so-called tax reform, which cut taxes on the wealthy. And in other words, the bottom line is that the United States is no longer satisfied with the global south basically being comprised of what they would call puppet states. They would like to turn their erstwhile allies into puppet states. And once again, the European Union, Canada, and to a degree Japan have been caught with their pants down, despite the fact of having hundreds of diplomats crawling around Washington. They could not foresee what some of us have seen as being inevitable. And it seems to me that the European Union, Canada, and Japan, in the first instance, should consider purging their foreign ministries and getting some intelligence into those hallowed halls.
You're listening to Professor Gerald Horn. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organized hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with Professor Gerald Horn, and we are discussing the mass migration crisis and the Trump administration's brutal response to the sight of poor black and brown migrants fleeing across the border from Mexico, seeking sanctuary from the poverty, destabilization, crime and violence that has been visited upon them, courtesy of US policy in the region. Gerald, where do you believe liberal America stands here? Because it seems to me that they are, clearly they are peddling these myths about the inherent good of America, its inherent virtue. It's increasingly difficult for them to keep up this pretense. And I suggest that the outcry, the inordinate outcry that we've witnessed in response to the Trump family separation policy has been a reflex, an attempt to bolster that myth, because essentially, I've said it before and I'll say it again, Trump is not a departure from the status quo. Trump is the status quo with his mask removed.
Well, I think you hit the nail right on the head. And I think that this has driven an ideological crisis in which you refer to as liberal America. That's to say, their mythologies about July 4th, 1776, delivering freedom and liberty, despite the fact that after the proclamation of the United States of America, the United States went on to oust Britain from control of the African slave trade. U.S. nationals were bringing more Africans to Cuba, which was then under Spanish rule by the 1790s than the Spanish were. By the 1840s, the U.S. nationals were largely responsible for a massive inflow of Africans from Congo and Angola to Brazil, which now has the largest black population on this side of Nigeria. But these hard facts are very difficult for many liberals to absorb. Instead, they've given us the fable that the 18th century U.S. Constitution, which really only spoke to the interests of those defined as white, supposedly is sufficiently flexible to speak to the rest of us, which is the looniest idea since Looney Tunes. It's almost the same that those who proclaimed apartheid in South Africa in 1948, that was a document and an edict that was sufficiently flexible to include Nelson Mandela. I mean, it's laughable. It's outrageous. But that's what passes for truth and reality in these United States of America.
Gerald, what's your analysis of Barack Obama's legacy? Where do you locate him in the history of black America? What role has he played, negative or positive? And how does the myth surrounding that legacy diverge from the reality?
So the ineradicable stain on the legacy of one Barack Hussein Obama has to be the invasion and overthrow of the Gaddafi regime in Tripoli, Libya in 2011. This not only created a riotous anarchy in North Africa that then spread southward into neighboring Mali, which allowed the religious zealots to then take over a good deal of that West African country, but it also helped to lubricate the path for many in Libya and point southward to try to flee across the Mediterranean into Italy, where as of today, they're facing a neo-fascist wall established by the new government in Rome. But it's not only that. With regard to the negotiating partners of Mr. Obama, I'm speaking of Moscow in the first place, it helped to sour relations, according to Michael McFaul, the former U.S. ambassador to Moscow in his recent memoir. And he suggests that Moscow felt traduced by the NATO-Obama-led invasion and overthrow of Gaddafi. They were led to believe that regime change was not on the agenda, that it was basically a responsibility to protect doctrine being implemented. But alas, that did not happen. And so I would say that on the one hand, you can see Mr. Obama as being a direct response to the 2007-2008 collapse on Wall Street, which led many, and particularly in what is now the Trump majority, to panic, as George W. Bush, the then U.S. president, said at the time, this sucker may go down. In other words, they thought the U.S. economy was about to collapse, and in their hysteria, they voted for Barack Obama, but he helped to stabilize the system to a certain degree, but it also led to this election of Donald J. Trump directly in 2016.
Would you say Donald Trump's election, Gerald, was a reflex against Obama on racial grounds, at least partly, a reflex against multiculturalism of which he was a symbol?
I think so. I think that the anti-Trump wing of the U.S. ruling elite is not necessarily hostile to multiculturalism because it allows them to draw upon a more diverse pool to administer the empire, with Barack Hussein Obama being exhibit A. However, the middle class and working class base of the Trump majority, they feel sometimes pushed out and elbowed aside by the rise of multiculturalism. And therefore, you can see the election of Donald J. Trump as being a kind of counter-revolution, just like 1776, the formation of the United States, was a counter-revolution against the idea of the abolition of slavery and against the idea of stopping the seizure of land of Native Americans.
That's a very interesting departure from the mythological history of the founding of the United States, that it was actually a regressive event rather than a progressive event, but it's always been couched in Enlightenment terms about democracy, about the end of monarchy, about the end of unearned privilege, taxation with representation rather than taxation without representation. How do these national myths, Gerald, manage to survive for so long? And do you detect that they're now starting to dissipate under the weight of the reality, which, as I said earlier, is completely detached from those myths in people's lived experience?
Well, the second part of your question is easier to answer. Yes, these myths are slowly but surely eroding under the weight of the insanity and horrific trends inaugurated by the election of Donald J. Trump, not least being the scandal on the Texas-Mexico border as we speak. I think that it's interesting that you mentioned the term enlightenment, because now I think scholars are beginning to see, and I articulated this in my latest book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean, that when you had the move in the 17th century away from religion as the axis of society, a Protestant versus Catholic, Catholic versus Muslim, Christian versus Jewish, Christian versus Muslim, etc., in North America, this was largely driven by the fact that they needed numbers in order to confront not only a rambunctious Native American population, but also they were dependent upon the labor of enslaved Africans who were conspiring with the Native Americans against the settlers. So in order to broaden the base of settler colonialism, there was this strategic move away from religion in order to increase the numbers so you could have a newly defined, newly formed so-called white population, which not only extended the base for potential settlers from the Atlantic to the Urals, but today in the United States, the term white can even be affixed to Lebanese Christians, to Iranians. And this is not a product of enlightenment. This is a product of racism and white supremacy and having a model for development that was grounded in settler colonialism and expropriation of the land of the Native Americans and enslavement of the Africans. Increasingly, scholars are beginning to recognize that that's the case, but sadly enough, it's not happening rapidly enough.
Okay. It's interesting that you mentioned settler colonialism, because this is obviously key. White supremacy and settler colonialism are two sides of the same coin. We've seen the same dynamic in Australia, and we see it today in Israel. Israel, for me, is a white supremacist state, predicated on the dehumanization and oppression of 4 million non-whites as so prescribed, i.e. the Palestinian people. Give us, if you would, Gerald, your understanding of the role that settler colonialism has played in modern history in terms of as part of a capitalist model of economics and its imperialist bedfellow.
Well, the good news, I would like to think, is that the formation of the State of Israel in 1947, 1948 was the last gasp of settler colonialism. I would like to think that. I would like to think that that would be the last time in human history that it was decided that those who had been suffering in Europe have to be compensated on the shoulders of those who are not, as used to be said in London, not of pure European descent, quote unquote. Settler colonialism, of course, came onto the world scene, particularly in the 17th century, I would say, hand in glove with the concept of capitalism. And I explained this in some detail, at some length in my book that I just mentioned. That is to say that with the expropriation of the land of the indigenous populations, particularly of North America and the Caribbean, and their replacement by enslaved Africans, you found that London in particular, which was the rising power at that particular moment, had the need to build ships to drag those Africans across the Atlantic, had the need to build ships in order to bombard the people of West Africa in particular and the indigenous populations of North America and to transport settlers across the Atlantic. This provides the seeds for this rising system known as capitalism because you needed laborers to build these ships who then would get paid wages and then would spend those wages on housing, on necessities, et cetera. You needed insurance companies as well to insure against slave revolts, which were quite frequent in terms of dragging Africans across the Atlantic. The capital then accrued was also very usefully deposited in banks who then, in a circle devoid of virtue, would then lend that capital out to the rising merchant class, who, by the way, had a particular triumph in London in 1688 with the so-called Glorious Revolution, which was not very glorious for Africans and Native Americans in the first place. And so you see a tight linkage between and amongst slavery, white supremacy, settler colonialism, and capitalism. And once again, I would like to think that that circle devoid of virtue came to a screeching halt in 1947, 1948 with the formation of the State of Israel.
Just finally, Gerald, we're coming to the end of the show. I'm minded of the quote by the Cuban national liberation leader, José Martí. He was a great inspiration for Fidel Castro when he said, "I have lived inside this monster and I know its entrails. And my sling is David's," referring to the United States. Where is the José Martí of today, Gerald? Is there a resistance movement emerging, either in the US or on the other side of the border, to this brutal, apartheid, imperialist, white supremacist juggernaut?
Oh, absolutely, there's a resistance movement. It's growing daily. And speaking across the border, pay close attention to the elections in Mexico on July 1st, which may lead to the election of Mexico's first leftist president in about 70 years. I'm speaking of AMLO, as he's called, Manuel López Obrador. Of course, as one could expect, there are a few flaws in his platform, but he would be a gigantic and a great leap forward with regard to Mexican leaders. And I dare say that when he's elected, he will serve to form a common front with Havana, with Caracas, with Bolivia and Evo Morales. And that, it seems to me, is some of the most heartening news that we have to look forward to.
You've been listening to Gerald Horn. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.